Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault. This week, we remember the pioneering work of Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann, who discovered the hallucinogenic properties of lysergic acid, known as LSD, in 1943. We present this outstanding 1974 documentary, 1 billion seconds later.
No man can escape the prison of robot society by himself. Once you have tuned in by turning on, you will see that it is easy to leave the game.
In 2006, on the occasion of Hofmann's 100th birthday, he told the crowd of well-wishers, LSD wanted to tell me something. It gave me an inner joy, an open-mindedness, a gratefulness, opened eyes, and an internal sensitivity for the miracles of creation. 1 billion seconds later is the first solo documentary from producer and now Pacifica Radio Archives preservation and access consultant and best friend, Addie Gevins. The program would win the prestigious Ohio State Award for Radio Excellence, the first of many awards, including two Peabody Awards for Ms. Gevins. This program, which is the first hour of a two-hour program, which you can get from the Pacifica Radio Archives, explores the social history of LSD, from its discovery at Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland, through the halls of academia, to Golden Gate Park in San Francisco and beyond. Included are the words from Albert Hofmann, Timothy Leary, Baba Ram Dass, Ken Kesey, Dr. John Lilly, and many more. They all describe the LSD experience and speculate on its use as a therapeutic tool, a religious sacrament, and a revolutionary or counter-revolutionary agent. And now here is the 1974 Pacifica documentary, 1 billion seconds later.
Oh, humans, the time has come for you to seek new levels of reality. Your egos and the human game are about to cease. You are about to be set face to face with the clear light. You are about to experience it in its reality. In the ego-free state, wherein all things are like the void and cloudless sky, and the naked, spotless intellect is like a transparent vacuum. At this moment, know yourself and abide in that state. Concentrate on the unity of all living beings. Hold on to the clear light. Use it to attain understanding and love.
Approximately 1 billion seconds ago, in the Sandoz Pharmaceutical Laboratories in Basel, Switzerland, an organic chemist named Albert Hofmann was working on the 25th preparation of D-lysergic acid, an isolysergic acid diethylamide derived from ergot of rye. This is an extract of the report he submitted to W.A. Stoll, the head of the laboratory.
Last Friday, April 16th, 1943. I was forced to stop my work in the laboratory in the middle of the afternoon and to go home, as I was seized by a peculiar restlessness associated with the sensation of mild dizziness. On arriving home, I lay down and sank into a kind of drunkenness, which was not unpleasant and which was characterized by extreme activity of imagination. There surged upon me an uninterrupted stream of fantastic images of extraordinary plasticity and vividness, and accompanied by an intense kaleidoscope-like play of colors.
In his search for a cure for migraine headache, this alchemist stumbled upon a discovery that has been described by Aldous Huxley as one of the three greatest achievements of the 20th century, ranking with the discoveries of DNA and atomic power. Michael Horowitz, psychedelic historian and director of the Fitzhugh Ludlow Memorial Library, spoke to Dr. Hofmann about his first experience with LSD.
Probably a drop of the solution came on my fingers.
I see.
And that was enough. And the very first experience was a very big one. And then I had more suspicions that could have come from this stuff. And then I played Metz's first experiment, planned experiment, with 0.25 milligrams.
Did you swallow it this time?
Yes, I am prepared a solution with 5 milligrams, and I took an equivalent. I expected that this first dose would not work at all, and I had planned to take more and more and more to get the symptoms, but that was already, you know.
And wasn't that 250 micrograms, that amount?
Yeah, Just the first, I planned to start with 250 and then to increase.
Yes.
Because there was no other substance who had any effect with so small dose.
You know, when you look at a little thing of LSD, a little of a dose it takes to get you off, you know? Just a microscopic, tiny little micro smidgen, you know? And you're wrecked. Yeah, just wrecked.
The gross changes in perception and sensation reported by Hoffman were interpreted by his colleagues as analogs of the only non-rational state of consciousness with which they were familiar, schizophrenia. During the next 7 years, Stoll and Hoffman and other European investigators began formal experimentation with LSD-25. In 1950, Dr. Max Wrinkle, a Boston psychiatrist, brought a quantity of the new chemical to the United States. In the words of Dr. John Lilly, LSD arrived in this country with a negative program. It was called a psychomimetic drug, and all its effects were explained by the assumption that it created a schizophrenic state. For a few more years, LSD remained in the control of a few psychiatrists who used it to investigate mental illness. Then, as the center of LSD research in the United States moved west, new dimensions began to evolve. At the International Foundation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park, California, doctors Harmon and Savage extended the use of LSD to the study of neuroses. Doses of from 50 to 200 micrograms began to be used in conjunction with psychotherapy to induce trance states and to relieve anxiety. As a result, the newest, most powerful mind-changing molecule was dispensed to a wider population under more favorable circumstances. Ken Kesey was one of the many artists and intellectuals who volunteered as subjects for early LSD research. He always likes to say that it was the government who gave him his first dose.
At the same time, the Army was investigating its uses. The Army considered it as a weapon for disorienting the enemy.
Dr. Frederick Myers, professor of pharmacology, and one of the founders of the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic.
The first way to look at the effects of acid is to look at the strict pharmacologic effects, the objectively observable actions of the drug. For example, it acts a little bit like speed. It's a mild stimulant. It speeds up the heart, elevates blood pressure slightly, dilates the pupil, and so forth. Now, what does it do to behavior objectively observed, independent of the significance that the experience has to the individual? Well, I think the way to describe the behavioral effects of acid is to say that it distorts perception. To call these drugs hallucinogens is a little bit inaccurate, in that people do not ordinarily see things that aren't there. They do not literally hallucinate. What the drug does is distort the perception of objects, of sensations that are present. Now, this distorted perception applies to all sensory modalities, all ways of sensing the environment. Given a number of people who experience the effects of acid, how they interpret or react to this distortion of perception depends on factors that are inherent in their personality and in their preconditioning. If I approach acid as a kind of objective-minded laboratory scientist, and I give it in a sterile and controlled laboratory situation, I find it a dull and anxiety-engendering experience. But someone else may take acid after they have been indoctrinated by some proselytizer, somebody who believes in the value of the experience, and his reaction may be totally different.
Aldous Huxley probably did more than any other human being to lift LSD-25 from the psychiatric framework in which it had been enmeshed. In The Doors of Perception, published in 1954, he describes mystical experiences he had while on mescaline. He argues that mescaline and lysergic acid are agents of transcendental experience and should be regarded as religious sacraments rather than as drugs which create pathological mental states. Huxley's book had a profound effect on many American artists and intellectuals. Dr. Houston Smith, professor of philosophy and religion, recalls,
"Well, the psychedelics came across my horizon with the arrival of Aldous Huxley as visiting professor to MIT in the fall of 1960. We'd known one another for a decade or so, and I had read his Doors of Perception with great interest. And during the time that he was in Cambridge, I spent as much time with him as I could. And the subject naturally turned to the psychedelics, and I asked him whether it was possible to have an experience with them. And he said, well, you might try calling Dr. Timothy Leary at Harvard. Now, that's the first time I had heard that name. I didn't know him, but he had himself just arrived there just a month after having himself taken, what was it, I guess, 7 mushrooms on the side of a swimming pool in Cuernavaca, which experience was to change the course of his life and in ways the course of American life as well.
Leary said of his experience with mushrooms, "It was the classic visionary voyage, and I came back a changed man. You are never the same after you've had that one flash glimpse down the cellular time tunnel. You are never the same after you've had the veil drawn."
After my own experience in Mexico, I felt that this was had opened up possibilities for self-understanding and for behavior change, which is dwarfed the techniques of talking, which frankly aren't very effective according to any measured criterion. So when I went back to Harvard that fall, I looked around for some way to make available to other people for therapeutic and life-changing purposes these experiences. Now, very fortuitously, that fall, Aldous Huxley was in residence at MIT in Cambridge. It was during the MIT centennial. I phoned Mr. Huxley, and he came over to Harvard and was in on the original planning of our research project there. We learned from Aldous Huxley to build into our project values which I say would be humanistic as opposed to doctor-patient or psychopathological or neurosis and sickness models of human nature.
That project was the Psychedelic Research Project, begun by Drs. Leary, Alpert, and Metzner under the auspices of Harvard's Social Relations Department in the fall of 1960. The purpose of the project was to explore the effect of psychedelic drugs on human consciousness in a naturalistic setting that would enhance subjective experience. These experiments were undertaken with psilocybin until the fall of 1961, when Michael Hollingshead arrived at the door of the psychedelic research project with a mayonnaise jar containing 1 pound of sugar and 1 gram of D-lysergic acid diethylamide tartrate 25.
And I the flame into which it is offered. I am the sire of the world, and this world's mother and grandsire. I am he who awards to each the fruit of his action. I make all things clean. I am Om. Om. Om.
This was really before any laws were passed or there was any great paranoia about materials. In fact, you could send away to pharmaceutical companies on letterhead and say, hey, some free samples, we want to do research. They would say, sure.
Alan Cohn recalls,
I was a graduate student at Harvard, had been an undergraduate. Dick Alpert had been my senior thesis advisor for 3 years. I had taken a course in existential methodology with Dr. Leary. Anyway, Tim and Dick were given most of the responsibility for the mandatory fieldwork course for all clinical psychology students. And very late in the fall, we started doing some fieldwork, and part of the institutions we visited were the prisons, Concord Prison, for one, in Massachusetts. And right around then, some of the inmates were taking psilocybin under a structured research project. And naturally enough, all the graduate students who wanted in the fieldwork course were certainly allowed to participate in what now is euphemistically called the early psychedelic research at Harvard.
Dr. Timothy Leary.
We run over 100 ingestions with these men, and we've never had a moment of friction or violence. Why? Because we spent many, many, many hours with them ahead of time explaining to them what was going to happen. We had members of our staff take the drug with them. The first person ever to take drugs in Concord State Prison was myself. And the reason I did that was to show them that we weren't doing anything to them. This was an experience that we believed in and we'd share it with them. Last time we ran a session there, we had graduate students from Harvard bringing oriental rugs into a state prison. The guards thought we were nuts. We were bringing in candles and tape recordings with the music they asked for. This was to set up a pleasant, supportive environment for them to lose their minds. And they proceeded to lose their minds in an ecstatic and a deeply religious type of experience. Well, when we were running into these religious reports by non-religious people, we felt we were out of our depth. So we went to professors and graduate students in the Divinity School. And we've been providing drug experiences for a large number, over 50 now, of these professional religious people. And they're among our best subjects, because for many of them, this is what they've been looking for all their life. Their expectations and their set is for some sort of revelatory, transcendent experience.
Thank you. Harvard experiments focused increasingly on the production and sustainment of transcendent religious experiences. On Good Friday of 1962, Walter Pahnke, a doctoral candidate at the Harvard Divinity School, set up an experiment in Marsh Chapel to determine empirically whether psychedelic chemicals can trigger religious revelations. Dr. Leary explains.
Last Good Friday, we turned on, in a double-blind study, 15 divinity students in a Boston church, and 15 other students took a placebo, that is, they took a sugar pill. We wanted to see what effect the drug would have. Now, these youngsters wanted to have a religious experience, and the environment, the setting, was very spiritual, hymns, candles, and so forth. And 9 out of the 10 reported the deepest experience, religious experience of their life.
The phenomenal ability of LSD-25 to trigger extraordinary experiences was being revealed to a wider public. The miracle of Marsh Chapel was described in newspapers and in Time magazine.
I remember Time magazine, and I remember saying to my mother, I was in 10th grade or something, "Man, I'd love to try this stuff." And she was saying, "What's that?" And I said, LSD-25. And there's this little column in Time, and she read it, and she just took it away from me, the whole magazine.
Alan Watts published The Joyous Cosmology, An Adventure in the Chemistry of the Mind. The glowing reports of musicians, artists, and poets, among them Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, William Burroughs, and Jack Kerouac, brought more and more volunteers to the project.
In late 62, as I recall, there was a secret, a closed meeting, semi-closed, held in the Social Relations Department, which the clinical psychology branch was a division of. And some professors gave speeches against this experimentation, mainly criticizing it for being non-academic. There was, I believe, a Harvard Crimson, that's the local Harvard newspaper, reporter there, and he blew it publicly and then started all the kinds of publicities. In May of that year, Tim took off down to Mexico, ostensibly, I think, to find a little retreat. And I believe he didn't return for finals, which didn't exactly excite some of the administrators. And I believe, my recollection is that's the reason they used to fire him.
The sensational publicity following the dismissals of Drs. Leary, Alpert, and Metzner from Harvard made it difficult to relocate the project intact.
I had my bags packed up in Massachusetts, waiting to go to each country that the group got kicked out of.
The group now dispersed and originated several short-lived LSD training centers dedicated to the dissemination of psychedelic substances and the investigation of the uncharted realms of human consciousness. In 1964, Billy Hitchcock provided a stage on which the group attempted to create a psychedelic society.
I'm cutting this tape on the third floor of the Castalia Foundation in Millbrook, New York. The Castalia Foundation is a psychedelic center, a place for consciousness expansion, a spiritual retreat, a center for experimentation in the use of psychedelic or mind-opening drugs. As you would expect from a place designed to produce beautiful experiences, the Castalia Foundation is located in a beautiful spot.
While transcendent consciousness was being studied on the East Coast, pandemonium was breaking out in the West. Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters set themselves loose on an unsuspecting America with a large quantity of the agent of the cosmic giggle. Maybe the psychiatrists were right. Maybe acid makes you crazy. Maybe that's what the world needs.
Yeah, well, you know, you'd see their bus all the time. Lunatics. You know, just, you know, I really sympathize with them.
The magic bus came to Millbrook.
We were the East Coasters, serious, depth-oriented, messianic almost in character. And these West Coast people, they seemed to just be goofing on some level, and on some level it was very appealing. I think we traded, I think we had two defections, one to each side at the end of that day.
Tambourine man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Though I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I am branded on my feet. I have no one to meet, and the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming.
The demand for LSD grew rapidly. Underground chemists began to create and dispense their wares. By late 1964, acid became readily available on campuses and in urban centers across the nation. More and more people were taking LSD. Many were taking it continually.
I was lucky that my first acid trip was a fantastic experience. It happened over at a friend's place in the midst of utter confusion and chaos. There were about 20 people tripping. Most of them were painting the apartment with their fingers. There were two tape recorders going, you know. There was blinking lights and Christmas trees and dancing and everything. And for a while, I observed people dancing and found that the whole sensation of my being became immensely pleasurable as time progressed. Until I started to, you know, really space out. And somehow managed to find a chair, a big armchair. And I completely lost all awareness of the confusion around me and sort of entered a region of white light, as it's called. And just ecstasy, pure ecstasy and formless ecstasy.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me in a jingle jangle.
It was so completely new that I didn't have any awareness of the fact that I had taken LSD while I was tripping. I was just in this place. I'd never been there before. And I didn't put a label on it. I would just be tripping along, and I would sort of, through this fog, I would hear someone say, I could just barely hear it. I would hear someone, like someone new would come into the room, and I would hear someone telling them that I had taken LSD, and it would just be like this wave of whoa. It was like, oh yeah, that's right, you know. But then it was gone. It didn't matter, and I would forget about it immediately until I heard someone say it again.
You're seeing that he's chasing. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me.
When I started to reflect upon the experience I had, I recognized, of course, the experience of Satori, and the whole Zen experience was akin to this. So what started to happen was that all of my understanding, all of my thinking, started to focus itself around this experience, you know. This was a more legitimate reality. It was as simple as that. But this experience, you know, was utterly self-validating. It made sense. You know, a lot of things became clear. If only because I realized that there was a better state to be in. By comparison, I recognized that my ordinary life was hardly adequate.
The link with mysticism is very, very strong. It's not like it catalyzed it in me, though. I felt like it was just reacquainting me with
what I'd always felt and known, and it just sort of verified a lot of things, the whole vibratory trip, you know.
Down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves.
I mean, I know what it is. It's like it stops time. It's like it'll freeze things, and within the space of a minute, you get more than a minute's worth of revelations. You get lifetimes worth of revelations, you know. I know I sit in my room sometimes when I'm tripping, and like a whirlwind inside your head to the, you know, to other people who are in the room. They could look at you and they could say, well, he's reading a book, or, oh, look, he's looking out his window, but your mind's screaming through outer space.
With all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves, let me forget about...
The cortex, the human brain, is like a huge jet airplane. Most of us, even the most enlightened of us, spend most of our time pushing this airplane around the ground, clumsily and feebly, because we don't have the key to the motors, and we don't know how to operate the plane. Now, what LSD does, it turns on the motor.
I'm thinking about it now. Words that just flashed were pragmatic mysticism, experimental mysticism, the induction of mystical, of the kind of classic mystical experience that Christ had, that Buddha had, that Muhammad had, that we all can have through the use of something like a tool, a pharmacological agent like LSD-25.
You are listening to the first hour of a two-hour documentary, 1 Billion Seconds Later, about the social history of LSD on From the Vault. For a copy of this program or the entire two-hour documentary, please call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. You can visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or visit our main site, pacificaradioarchives.org. And now back to the program.
Everywhere, people were abandoning their former lives to be true to their acid visions.
I reviewed my situation. By the time I was at the end of my junior year, in terms of what I was doing, my life, what I wanted, and so on. And I recognized quite clearly that I thought it was worth pursuing the metaphysics, the physics of experience. That it was what I was looking for all along. That obviously there weren't being any courses given. I would have not the slightest notion as to how to go about proceeding. So the decision for me to quit was so utterly natural that I never had a second thought about it. When I tried to explain it to others, I recognized that, you know, I was facing an immense difficulty. And I didn't recognize at all in the beginning really the dimensions of the difficulty of trying to communicate, in other words, to somebody else, especially people who have not had this sort of experience, exactly as to what your motivation is.
Groups of trippers began to form in order to transform their lives to encompass their acid experiences. Soon these groups began to communicate in underground papers, newsletters, and especially through music.
I really think that every politician, everybody that pushes a button or has power, should be made to take a few psychedelic voyages, you know, and just clear out the cobwebs in his head before he goes figuring out what's right for me, you know. I'd be willing to do that for my constituents. I don't see why they won't do it for me, you know.
It seemed that an enlightened world could be achieved now that nirvana was democratically available to all. The only thing that remained to be done was to turn everybody on.
It was usually connected with, like, the San Francisco bands, basically the Grateful Dead. I mean, that's how I came to see a lot of things, is I was just following the dead around. They're the perfect, like, vehicle for LSD, and I'm convinced. I hate to say fanatical statements because I'm really distrustful of fanatics, but I am a Grateful Dead fanatic, and when I'm 95 years old, I can see myself with earphones, you know, in a wheelchair, you know, listening to Grateful Dead using rolling dope, you know. People get the chance to see him, they should take some LSD and go stand in front of Phil Lesh, you know. He's got a quadraphonic bass, and let him, you know, tickle their brains for a while. See God. Yeah, they definitely are an LSD band. Definitely. It's amazing, like, all the You see how the music evolves from different places and how much effect LSD had on everything here in San Francisco and the whole acid rock, you know, that chuck and jive thing.
There was talk of the creation of a new culture.
You cannot drop out externally until you have detached yourself internally. You must leave your job. You must leave your school. You must leave the city. You must leave all of your social connections, which do not make sense to your sense organs and your cells. You cannot do this alone in acts of isolated rebellion. Detaching yourself from the insanity of society requires group action. Your cells will tell you that you are a primate, a tribal animal, one who moves in groups or packs. No man can escape the prison of robot society by himself. Once you have tuned in by turning on, you will see that it is easy to leave the game. You have been born into an insane asylum, and it is simple and obvious to take advantage of the insanity around you to make your escape. One of the most obvious symptoms of the current social insanity is man's lemming-like rush to the cities. Take advantage of this insanity. You will find within 3 hours' drive from any American city, deserted towns, deserted farmhouses, vast regions of forest and meadow and farmland, which can be rented or bought. As the insane society of adults around you rushes to enslave itself to machines, you will find an increasing market for craftsman-like work or for the production of articles which are too beautiful or too private to be made on mass assembly lines, but not in rebellion. Drop out by tuning in. As you drop out, you will find that you do nothing which is not an act of beauty. And this is how you will make your living. Because nothing made by a machine can please a sense organ of a human being or can make sense to the cellular wisdom inside a human being. Every time in the last few weeks that I have repeated this message, turn on, tune in, and drop out, I have been besieged by entreaties from my middle-aged friends. You can't say that, they tell me. But what I am saying is not reckless advice. It happens to be the oldest message of human wisdom. Look within, find your own divinity, detach yourself from social and material struggles. What is reckless is the American education system today, which puts young people on a mass assembly line geared to produce robots. American education does neurological damage. The schools and colleges of this country are designed and supported by parents who wish their children to become like them, which means like grandmother.
The number of people sharing this vision swelled dramatically. Rock dancers and beings celebrating the psychedelic experience attracted large numbers of very young people, many of whom had no idea how profound and disruptive an experience could be induced by the ingestion of LSD.
I've seen psychotic breaks, I think, precipitated by the use of acid. But I think these people were heading for trouble in any case. So I don't think the total number was much influenced. The time at which the break occurred, I think, could have been influenced by the drug.
The LSD psychosis became a popular object of the press. It was linked with crime, illicit sex, and rebellious youth.
I've had trips that don't really start, you know, and they get really bad, but they weren't as bad as in the Art Linkletter movies, you know, when the people are just shriveling up and turning into, you know, incredible maniacs.
The tragedy is that the LSD panic today is seen as a psychiatric problem. And of course, a psychiatrist can't deal with a person whose ontological crisis is occurring or whose sense of reality is distorted. You can't use logic to talk to a 2 billion-year-old energy process that's converting things into a cellular flow. The tragedy is that the LSD panicked person is dragged off to a mental hospital and treated as a nut. And then this can result in several weeks of confusion and depression and anxiety. Our recommendation is to see the LSD experience as life itself, as a religious quest, a religious confrontation, and not as a psychiatric pathological situation.
Like play a peace title. Oh Lord, don't let them drop that atomic bomb on me.
By 1966, it was obvious that LSD was going to become illegal. Leary and his associates sought to abort this prohibition by forming a religion. LSD was its sacrament.
3 months ago, we formed a new religion called League for Spiritual Discovery. Like every other religion, we have our own sacramental methods and our own goals, and we practice the religion in small groups privately. But like other religious groups, we have our public educational and demonstration ceremonies, which we call celebrations. The aims and goals of our religion are highly orthodox. We seek to find the divinity within, call that what you will. But it's been well known for thousands of years that man can focus his microscope inside and turn on to energies and revelations which are built into your nervous system and your cells. We are attempting to get people to turn inside, to look within, and to turn on. And we don't care what sacrament people use. Throughout human history, the human race has used the most incredible variety of techniques for turning on.
But it was too late. Public fear was running wild.
These drugs are dangerous to several groups of people. They're dangerous to anyone who has a vested interest in any of our psychological or psychiatric or educational programs. Because there's no question in our mind that we open up new possibilities of learning without teachers, of understanding yourself without doctors, and of coming to an awed and reverent understanding of life without a spiritual guide or a minister. Now, this is going to play havoc with lots of the games that are being played and lots of the control which is being exercised in our society.
There are many people who have a vested interest in maintaining and even exaggerating current problems. These we call careerists, people who will convert a social problem to a private career.
I went to high school during the week and tripped on the weekends. And I used to, sometimes I would come home and I would tell my parents about my trip, essentially, except I wouldn't mention that I had dropped anything. And they would sit there and say, oh, how wonderful, and really get off on it. But at the same time, my mother would say that LSD, it was one trip and your mind was blown for the rest of your life. You were lost and insane. And I would sit there with my 200 trips behind me, and she always thought I was the sanest person in the world.
But in addition, there was the big factor of unfamiliarity, and then the frightening to the middle class, the frightening consequences of people accepting the suggested philosophy that went with acid. The older generation is not resigned to the fact that that we are no longer able to provide interesting careers for a large percentage of our young people. And they are fearful when they see any influence that adds to the passivity of their children, that takes them away from the goal-directed, exam-monitored kind of progress in school.
She never would, in her wildest dreams to this day, would suspect that I had ever eaten any LSD. Because obviously I would be completely insane if I'd eaten LSD, and here I am, 5 beta kappa, and the two things are not possible together. Yeah.
Love is but a song we sing, here away we die. You can make the mountain.
By 1967, commercial interests were developing around LSD. The existence of a counterculture was announced by the American media. Look magazine, head shop owners, and managers of rock bands began to advertise the Summer of Love in San Francisco. The Oracle sent invitations.
If you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea. But first, are you experienced?
Dr. Frederick Myers.
And sure enough, in the summer '67, there were some thousands of exploring, middle-class, uninitiated kids descended upon the Haight. In anticipation of this, in the winter of '67, one of the early members of the hip community, Bob Conrich, came to a couple of doctors, David Smith and me, and predicted accurately what was going to happen the following summer. So beginning that winter, these people began to prepare a free clinic in anticipation of handling people who would not understand available medical facilities and who would need some kind of temporary help. So that there were observers in close contact with these kids during that summer. The summer was extremely interesting because it gave us experience with only partially indoctrinated users of acid.
First time I ever took it was like these people gave it to me and they didn't tell me they were giving it to me. And we were in a doggy diner, and I remember getting really high. I can barely remember it now, you know, and it seems like something I watched on TV. It doesn't seem real to me, you know, because I laughed a lot. You know, the first trip, you just laugh a lot.
Haight-Ashbury meant a lot of things to a lot of people. For some, it was a Fort Lauderdale Easter vacation psychedelicized. For others, it was a time of intense experimentation in unconventional living. For a brief interlude, it seemed that all rules and obligations had been suspended. It was a time of exalted optimism.
And these kids turned out not to be committed to the hip ethic or the hip religion, if you want to think of it that way. They turned out to be exploring middle-class kids, most of whom disappeared on Labor Day to return to school or home.
In a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
The Summer of Love became one of the major media events of the decade. Suburban couples toured the Hate in Greyhound buses. The hippie and the flower child took their places among the major figures of American folklore.
Now, the effect of the drug in these people was of great interest because it varied quite widely. Most of these kids, when they experimented with acid, had a great deal of anxiety. They were still fighting Mama and Papa, fearful of the scare stories in the San Francisco Chronicle, and we saw a lot of so-called bad trips, which reflect anxiety in the face of the experience. Labor Day of 67 was an important date in that most of those kids went home. We were left with pretty much the dregs, people who sorted themselves out because they had major psychiatric problems or were vulnerable to major drug effects.
The picture presented in the media failed to communicate the spiritual and cosmic revelations underlying this social phenomena. The threatening potential inherent in the banding together of a large number of people in an effort to create a new culture was successfully diluted. Merchants seized upon the outward trappings of the rejection of modern materialistic society and reduced rebellion to style. Psychedelia, objects designed to mimic or enhance the psychedelic experience, became big business.
Never glimpse the truth when it's all too late, when they pass away.
While stressing the attractiveness of braless young women, beads, and incense, the newspapers continued to inform their readers of the perils of drug taking. The great chromosome panic began.
Meiotic chromosomes of six mice injected with high doses of lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD-25, and of six controls were studied. Several breaks, gaps, and unidentified fragments were found in the treated but with a few exceptions not in the control animals.
Dr. James Hart.
Most of the studies that have been done have shown that LSD will produce chromosome breaks, and the typical thing they use is lymphocytes, cells taken out of the body and then administered concentrations of lysergic acid. And sure enough, in most cases, in most of the studies, chromosome breaks do appear. Well, it's interesting, however, that if you administer caffeine or aspirin or chemicals like this, you can also produce chromosome breaks in lymphocytes taken out of the body. A chromosome break in one kind of cell doesn't necessarily mean a chromosome break is also going to occur in the germ cells, which is where it's critical.
Dr. John Lilly.
In 1965, there were 210 research projects authorized by the National Institute of Mental Health on LSD. As the taking of LSD by young people in this country increased and more of the youngsters on bad trips were seen in psychiatric outpatient departments, a great national fear developed, encouraged by the press and magazine. This fear of LSD then generated national scare programs attempting to frighten people away from the use of these substances. A negative educational program was set up, giving only the negative side of the effects of these substances. Objective, rational research became almost impossible under the glare of publicity which resulted. In 1969, of the original 210 projects in research within the establishment, there are only six surviving ones. At the very time when research is needed most, the authorized research was cut back to a safe level of mediocrity.
Research is in a sense almost a classic free market kind of situation where if there's a demand for a certain kind of research implied by the money, coming down from Washington, then there will be people, researchers, who will be glad to accept the money to do the research, even if they've decided in advance, what the results ought to be. And in many cases, it was pretty clear from the prevailing, government attitudes and the sort of socio-political climate what results were expected. And if you did get negative results, negative in the sense of, no harm or minimal harm, your funding for the next year was in danger. Well, why do people get so excited about chromosome breaks in LSD and they don't get excited about chromosome breaks from caffeine or aspirin or having dental x-rays? And I think the answer is obvious that, they're not basically upset about the chromosome breaks. They're upset about the LSD.
And that does it for this week's program. We'd like to thank Addie Gevins for her incredible work on this documentary and as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project as a longtime consultant and BFF. Thanks, Addie. If you would like to join our campus campaign sponsoring school libraries across the country, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us at 1-800-735-0230. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.